Thanks everyone for coming. Sorry for the delayed start. So today we have Lisa Mickle from the University of Sheffield here to talk about effective metrics from group field theory. Take it away.
Okay, so hi everyone. Thank you very much for having me today and for letting me go all the way to PI. It's a very nice place. I'm very happy to be here. So today I'll talk a bit about the work that I did during my PhD, and most notably I'll focus on, well, this preprint on archive that came out this week, and talk a bit of like how we can reconstruct a metric from group field theory, and more specifically how we can apply this to cosmology and maybe do some phenomenology with it. So to start with, I want to give you a bit of an overview of what we're going to talk about or where to put this work. So we all know and love general relativity, and we know it's like highly successful and has stood a lot of tests of time. But we also know that for multiple reasons, we might expect there to be a more complete theory of quantum gravity. And okay, in particular, I'll talk about group field theory and its application to cosmology. So often, if we have a complicated quantum gravity theory, we want to apply it to, well, maybe a more simpler setting. And cosmology is very nice because we have a lot of symmetry. And then a first test can be like to see whether we can resolve the initial singularity at the Big Bang. And so also in GFT, you can actually have some cosmological models where we do achieve that. So once this part is kind of ticked off, a next step would be to maybe connect to perturbations, because once we have perturbations in cosmology, we can connect to other observations like the CMB. And also there, like most notably now, we have some tensions like the H0 tension or the sigma 8 tension. So maybe in some way, if we can go a bit further with quantum gravity, we might be able to get there at some point. And the specific way we want to do this is to look at GFT and then extract like some effective metric, which obviously makes it very nice to connect to classical theory, and then maybe we can go to perturbations. Once we have an effective metric, of course, we can do a lot of things. So maybe we can also study other types of spacetimes, which is something I won't talk about today, and we might explore in like future work. Okay. So this is just the overview of my talk. So I'll give a brief introduction to group field theory and how it's been applied to cosmology already. Then I'll look at introducing a relational coordinate system for group field theory. From this, we can define some new GFT operators. And from these operators, we get the effective metric that I already mentioned. And then finally, we'll look at the application to cosmology, where the background is what we've already talked about in our publication. And then I'll just try to relate to some different types of connecting it to perturbations. Okay, so let's start with GFT. Okay, so group field theory is a field theory where we don't have spacetime, but we have a field theory on a group manifold. Our main object is a bosonic group field, which we denote as phi, and it has some group arguments, and then we also can couple some additional real value functions. So there's different possibilities of what kind of group elements you can have, and also the number of these valued functions that you can have and what they represent. But today specifically, we'll want to have we'll have the group arguments to be four elements of SU2, because then we can connect nicely to loop quantum gravity and spin networks. And then our real valued functions will be taken to be master scalar fields, which are real valued functions. Okay, so once we have this group field, the excitations of this field are seen as our basic building blocks of spacetime. So you can picture them as small tetrahedra, or equivalently as a tetrahedra to be one of your vertices in the spin network, where the sides of each tetrahedron will then carry these different group elements here as an element of SU2. The dynamics we obtain from an action, where here we have our kinetic term, and then we also have some type of potential. So how, I'm not going to talk about specific types of the potential, but in principle, if you choose the right type of potential, you can reproduce different spin foam models. And also the kinetic term can be chosen so that you reproduce EPRL-like amplitudes. So here in particular, for the kinetic term, we impose that it has some symmetries that we already have in the classical symmetry. So we have, for instance, if these are scalar fields, we want the kinetic term to also have a symmetry with respect to, for instance, the translation of the scalar fields. So we can here perform a kind of expansion in N, where these will be some constants, and here we have the Laplacians on, in this case, on R4, so it depends on how many of these fields we have.
But then the Laplacians act on field space, not on space-time.
Yeah, on field space, so they will act on the field. So these will be these will be derivatives with respect to the chi, so with respect to these, the field arguments.
How do you make sure that you get a Laplacian and something which you can interpret in space-time?
Sorry?
How do we make sure that for the scalar field you get an action which looks like space-time Laplacian applied to phi squared?
So you mean how I derive this kind of thing? So we start with a...
At least in some limit you want to get the meta field action to be... It's a massless scalar field. You want to get phi Laplacian phi, where the Laplacian is a space-time Laplacian.
So
you get that from this.
No, so in this case, it's more an assumption of how this acts on the group field. So I don't want this to get to be my the action of my massless scalar field.
I'm asking, how do we make sure that in the end you get?
So at this point, I think we're not making sure.
Okay.
All we said is that we have some kinetic term in our group field that will depend on on the massless scalar fields that we want, and then we only impose that the symmetries that we have in the classical action are also respected in the action of the group field theory. Mm-hmm. And then from there we do this kind of expansion, and that's it at this point.
Mm-hmm. So you mean for the scalar fields there will be some shift symmetry? Because
yes, so you have shift symmetry, you have the chi go to minus chi inversion symmetry, and then you can have Euclidean rotations as well. Mm-hmm. So in particular, so if you start in general, you'll have this kinetic term will just be the difference of two fields squared, and then we do an expansion around this difference of two field values, and this is how you end up with the Laplacian. Mm-hmm. And then later on, so here this is in general, and later on we'll focus only on the first two terms and make a truncation in this infinite series. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes, so this is the main setup, and then the idea is that when we want to recover some kind of macroscopic geometry, we want to look at several building blocks. So as we have more of these small tetrahedra, we see that space-time was seen as to be emergent. So in particular in cosmology, we usually focus on isotropic tetrahedra, so they all have the same kind of group elements connected to their different sides. And then dynamically, we generate more and more of these building blocks, and then we say, okay, we can have some homogeneous universe, or this will give us the universe in the late time limit. Okay. So now I'm going to talk a bit more about the application to cosmology. So before I already said we can have multiple scalar fields, but if we just want to do homogeneous cosmology, it's actually enough to couple one scalar field that we use as a relational clock. So the dynamics will be defined with respect to the value of the scalar field. And then the way we get some kind of effective cosmology is that we look at the volume operator that in group field theory you can import from loop quantum gravity. And then if you take the expectation value over suitable semi-classical states, you can say that, okay, this expectation value of the volume operator should give us the volume element, which would be the scale factor cubed. And then from this, you can recover a Friedmann equation and actually compare it to general relativity. So from the action, there's different ways we can actually obtain some dynamics. So one is the mean field approach, where you look at something like the Schwinger-Dyson equations, and the other one is that you actually do a deparameterization with respect to your clock field and define a Hamiltonian and then continue with canonical quantization. So both of these approaches have been studied for cosmology, and in both of these approaches you can get an effective Friedmann equation that will agree with general relativity at late times, and also you get a certain bounce, so you resolve the singularity that you'd have in GR. Now, there's also been some studies on one paper, most notably quite recently, on the difference between these approaches. So, for instance, for cosmology, it appears that for the mean field approach, whether you get some effective Friedmann equation actually depends on the choice of state that you have here for the effective volume operator, Whereas if you look at the Hamiltonian framework with a single scalar field, it seems that already on the level of the operators, you actually get something that looks like an effective Friedmann equation. So it seems to be less state dependent.
So about the Laplacian that Bianca asked about.
Yes.
It's a Laplacian on field space, but not on space-time. So how do you make sure that these Friedmann, this effective Friedmann equation is a second order equation? Does it depend on your choice n of power that you had in the previous slide?
So, if I understand your question correctly, you're asking if, depending on at which point I truncate the series, if I get the same type of Friedmann equation or not.
So, for instance, able to describe higher curvature actions with this ansatz?
I'm not sure. So in the Hamiltonian approach specifically, you kind of want to truncate after two terms in this because that is straightforward for canonical quantization. In the mean field approach, I'm not sure if there've been any studies for higher n and what kind of Friedmann equation you get. And then the second point you made is, sorry, you said something about higher curvature.
I think actually you answered my second question by just saying that what you do is a quadratic theory in a sense, so
it's truncated. Yes, exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Hamiltonian means you take chi0 as time first,
yes,
and then you define.
I'll talk a bit more about the Hamiltonian and how we get it in a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe it's the. Like two more slides, and then we can talk a bit more about the Hamiltonian. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So this A is probably not discrete, right?
No. So this is really this identification because we want to connect to GR. So this would be the scale factor that you have in your Friedmann metric.
So you would say that like the full quantum theory is not gapped.
Sorry.
It's gapless. Like your theory is gapless.
Is what?
Gapless.
Yes, so this is really the effective region, right? Where you just look at this expectation value of your volume operator.
Right, so then, you mean you take the continuum limit or some kind of thermodynamic limit or something like that?
So the idea is that once you have enough of your microscopic building blocks, you want to have some kind of emergent geometry. So then you make this identification with a classical variable where now you no longer see, because this is, okay, so also, so the volume operator has discrete values, but the evolution in time is continuous.
Okay.
So once you start with having, the idea is that at some point you won't really see this discreteness anymore because you've kind of waited long enough.
Okay.
Okay, so just to finish off for the idea of having like GFT cosmology, there's some like further extensions of this, just to show that, okay, maybe we can do some different types of phenomenology with the set of group field theory. So what I talk about today, I'll neglect interactions, but some people have tried to include different interaction terms and see what this will do to the evolution of this volume operator at late times. So in particular, an older paper, you can find that you can introduce some kind of cyclic cosmology if you choose two interaction terms with specific powers in your fields. And another approach looked at including different types of field modes. So usually in cosmology, we want only one type of field mode because it's expected to dominate at late times. But if you include different ones, you can have something that looks like dark energy at late times. Furthermore, you can maybe try to look at different types of tetrahedra, where in this paper here, instead of having isotropic tetrahedra, they consider different types of anisotropic tetrahedra, but you find that the universe actually isotropizes at later times. And then finally, there's some results on perturbations in GFT, which I'll talk about a bit more later. Okay. So now we actually want to construct the effective metric, and for this we introduce this relational coordinate system. So I already said we want to, instead of having just one field that corresponds to our clock coupled to our tetrahedron, we will actually add three more, so we have four in total. And well, the idea is that we can use these to span a relational coordinate system. So obviously on the quantum variables, you only kind of have a tetrahedron with your four values. But we can relate this to something like general relativity by saying that we actually want, in the classical picture, our coordinate system to be spanned by these scalar fields. So particular in the rational coordinate system, this kind of identification here holds. I already said this. Okay, so this, again, has already been used to study perturbations in group field theory in the mean field approach. In group field theory, like I said before, you usually use the volume operator from loop quantum gravity. So there you can start studying perturbations of this volume operator. But because you only have this one volume operator, you can also only study perturbations of the volume element in the classical side. So you're a bit limited as what kind of quantities you can actually look at. Okay, and then there was also some extension where instead of considering only space-like tetrahedra, they proposed a theory where you have two different types of tetrahedra. One is space-like and one is time-like. And then from some entanglement, you can, in this kind of paper, they can match to some dynamics of general relativity. Okay. So here we're not going to look at the mean field approach. We're actually going to look at the Hamiltonian approach. And then we're going to define some new operators to kind of circumvent this issue of only having the volume operator. So the main idea to introduce these new operators is to use this translational invariance with respect to the mass of scalar fields that we have. So on the classical side, when you have a free scalar field action, it's obviously invariant on the translations of this field. And from this, you get a conserved current, which specifically is given, by the terminal of the metric, the inverse metric, and then you have some gradients of your field. But if you go to the relational coordinate system that I introduced earlier, this term will just be a delta. So you can actually, the form of this conserved current in this coordinate system is directly related to the components of your metric. And then the conservation law that follows from the symmetry in the classical side is just your Klein-Gordon equation for your scalar field. So now the idea is to also, on the GFT, where this is still classical and we haven't actually quantized anything yet, we can define something like this GFT stress energy tensor, which also comes from the symmetry of our fields or our theory with respect to these translations. And now, I just want to say that while I showed you the general action before, we're going to now look at these second order terms and the kinetic term only, and also we're going to neglect all kind of interactions. Okay, and then here we also get obviously a conservation law for this GFT stress energy tensor, and the way we want to actually get this effective metric is then instead of having the expectation value volume operator related to the classical volume element, we want to relate the expectation value of the quantized GFT stress energy tensor to the classical conserved currents, which are directly related to the metric.
But how is this GFT stress energy tensor related to the usual stress energy tensor?
You mean the stress energy tensor that you have in JR for the matter content?
Yeah, I mean, which is kind of derivative with respect to matrix. So, yeah.
So this stress energy tensor is not related to the matter stress energy tensor of your field. It's just the way you would usually define your stress energy tensor in a field theory.
Yeah, but why do you want to relate it to the Klein-Gordon field? Or it's not the equation of motion you say you want to
So you want to say that, okay, we have a quantum theory and we have a classical theory, and both of these have the same symmetry with respect to some translation, and this will lead to some conservation law, so some conserved quantity, and now we want to relate the conserved quantities that we have in both of these different theories.
And previously you talked about perturbations.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, if I think about perturbations in cosmology, these are perturbations in space-time.
Mm-hmm.
But now you say perturbations in mean field theory, where in mean field theory I usually assume kind of the same state for each building block.
Yes, okay,
is it homogeneous or what is perturbed? Is it a perturbation as a function of the scalar fields?
Yes, so we'll get back to that later as well, where there's the definition of perturbations and these kind of frameworks is actually quite different. So I'm not going to talk more about the mean field, but if you do this for the mean field and also, also, okay, so once you have this relational coordinate system, right? You can say, okay, my volume operator, for instance, which is what you study in the midfield approach, can now have a dependence on space, right? So it gets a few more arguments.
On the chi's.
On the chi's, exactly. But then if you say you're in a relational coordinate system, assuming that that is well defined, so you need to have some non-degeneracy condition with respect to these different chi's, then you can study inhomogeneities in your volume operator. And then that what you actually find depends a lot on the type of state you choose. So here, you usually also choose a coherent state that's highly peaked. And then you see how this state will evolve with respect to your dynamics, also with respect to these chi's.
So somehow the claim is that having one tetrahedra, and I assume all these four scalar fields sit at one vertex, mm-hmm. one given tetrahedra, and that's the same as having different tetrahedra in space-time with different chi's.
So you have a lot of tetrahedra with different chi's, is that what you're saying?
That's what I want, but I'm not sure you have that because you make the mean field approach, which kind of assumes you have at least the same state for each tetrahedron, no?
Yes, and then let me just see if I remember the mean field approach correctly, but you have as the same state associated to each of the tetrahedra, but then this state is peaked differently on these different values of chi.
I mean,
so it's kind of like an inhomogeneous state that sits on all of these tetrahedra.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking, how do you know that you don't describe a homogeneous cosmology with four homogeneous scalar fields?
I guess the question is, how do you know? It's a proposition, right? So we want to see what kind of effective dynamics we can extract from this kind of proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, isn't what Bianca said exactly what you want to say about like being, you pick a coherent state where it's peak on one configuration?
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what Bianca said, right? Just
yes.
Like all the tetrahedra are just the same configuration. Well, pretty much semi-classically the same configuration.
That's what I'm asking. But
yeah.
Then the idea of perturbation is that they are space-time.
Yeah.
Then the question is, what is space time?
Okay, so
that's kind of the proposal assumption that
yes, so
variation in the chi's is a space time variation in the end.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Am I being completely outside? Is it like a mean field is like a homogeneous, and then around that there is like
okay, so in the mean field approach, you say that okay, so you have the same wave function for each of the different tetrahedra, and then the wave function that you choose is peaked around different values of these chi fields.
Is it that the mean value is the peak, and then at different chi values, you have different tetrahedrons, and slightly off that peak or not? It's like they're all.
So, sorry.
Yeah, there's one wave function. But the wave function does depend on the chi's.
Yes.
And the group elements. And the proposal is that the chi's can be somehow, in the end, you treat them as space-time coordinates. That's a proposal. You know, I'm doubtful, but that's what is proposed.
But it would be nice if you could give me A as a function of different chi's, then I would be able to get the inhomogeneities, right?
Yes, so in some way that is what emerges once you take this the expectation values, right? So in the end, what you say is that, okay, so you have, in the mean field approach, you have each of these tetrahedra will have a specific wave function, okay? And then you start having, as the dynamics evolve, you get more and more of these tetrahedra, and thereby you also, the volume operator also evolves in time, and so the expectation value, the expectation value of the volume operator also evolve in time, and if you then relate that to your volume element, you will get a scale factor that then in principle will depend on these, on the different values of chi. Okay, yes. So this is the main proposal. And here the proposal is now, instead of having a volume operator and expectation value of the volume operator, we want to look at two different quantities that come from the same symmetries in the classical and the quantum theory. So that's the main proposal. So this is kind of the main bit of these new operators. Was there a question? No.
Can I?
Yeah, of course.
Ask kind of a vague question. So have people looked at like perturbation around fixed points that are not coherent states?
No.
Like a condensate of some sort, like.
So okay, so the in GFT, the work that's been done on perturbations so far is really having this mean field where you look at the volume operator, and there you have like highly peaked coherent states that are really very much peaked on these around these values.
Yeah.
And today we're also going to look at coherent states, and then what you can do for different types of states is maybe a bit less clear. I mean, the thing is also because whenever you want this kind of identification, you need a state that is semi-classical with respect to something. So coherent states are usually a good candidate for these kind of things. Okay, so now we're going to go back to talking about the Hamiltonian approach, what we actually do in the Hamiltonian approach. So what we do is we pick one of the four fields as our clock field, and we deparameterize with respect to this clock field. And then we also carry out a Fourier decomposition with respect to the other three fields, which are now our spatial fields. So then in particular, what we end up with is our field that we had before is still decomposed with respect to some group modes, but now we also have this decomposition with respect to the fields, so we have the K modes, and it still depends on our clock field. And then we also have the conjugate momentum, and we impose equal time commutation relations at the same value of our clock field, to be given by this formula over here. And then from this, we do, and from the Lagrangian, we can construct a Hamiltonian for, like, with this Fourier decomposition, which was already done in the work by Stefan and Axel. And we end up with this equation here. So now, notably, we have this parameter omega, which we'll see again in a bit, which depends on something we'll call m and also k. So this m here is the ratio of the factors that appeared in the kinetic term in our action, and then, yes, okay, depends on which type of modes we're looking at. So now going from here, we can do the kind of standard definition of our phi and its momentum in terms of A and A dagger operators, where these capital A operators here are now dynamical, and we can solve the equations of motion from in the Heisenberg picture by looking at the Hamiltonian. And then what we also find is once we do this rewriting in terms of these A operators, where the small A operators are now the stationary ones and time independent, we can actually get two types of Hamiltonian. So one of them is a squeezing Hamiltonian, and one of them is the Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator. So and which one we're in will actually depend on the sign of omega squared. And if we now remember that omega depends on m and k, we can see that it somehow depends on these values of these terms that appear in our kinetic term, but also what kind of wave modes we're looking at. So in particular, whenever k is large, I will get a positive omega, and I will be in this kind of squeezing regime. So the reason we call it the squeezing Hamiltonian is that modes that fall into this category will have a growing number of quanta, so the number operator for these modes will grow within time, whereas for the oscillating modes, the number of these quanta will just become like stay constant. So because of this, when we look at cosmology and what I say from now on, we're mostly interested in squeezing modes, because if we have a constant number of quanta, we won't have anything like an expanding universe, so we have no hope in really extracting something that looks like general relativity. However, in general, we can obviously have different types of modes, and we can have a mix of these type of modes which might have some kind of interesting phenomenological implications. Okay, so from the same, so now we have the setup with our different operators, we can now go back to, where was it here? This GFT stress energy tensor that we had, and now also imposes quantization. So we replace all the phi and the pi's with their respective operators, and then we replace these with our A operators, whose dynamics we now know, to reconstruct an operator for our G of T such n tensor, which we denote with this curly T. The next step to avoid any kind of divergencies is that we actually impose a normal ordering procedure for this operator in terms of our time-independent operators. And then we can show that the conservation law for this operator that we know has to hold classically will also hold at the level of the operators even after normal ordering. So in particular, without choosing any kind of states, if we remember that on the classical side, the classical current that we have just gives us our Klein-Gordon equation. The G of T, what we say corresponds to this, to the classical conserved current, has the same conservation law. So we can say that the Klein-Gordon equation will also hold in G of T, even without taking any kind of expectation values. So that's kind of the first step if we believe this identification that we made before. Okay. And now once we've done this this quantization, we check that the conservation law is fine, we can now see what kind of phenomenology we get from this proposal that we made by saying that the classical current can be obtained from the expectation value of our quantum operator in this case. Okay, yeah, so that's what we're going to do now. So how exactly does this work? So we start, we remember what we look at in cosmology. So we have the flat FLRW metric, where we have a lapse function and the scale factor. And we now want to, reproduce some scenario that is similar to this. So the operator that we constructed so far obviously knows nothing about a physical scenario that we're interested in. So in our proposal, what physical scenario we're in actually comes from the choice of state. So the first thing is that we need something that's sufficiently semi-classical. And in this case, we'll choose some coherent state or like a Fock coherent state. So there's been some studies, also by Stefan and Axel, where they tried different types of coherent states. And they found the Fock coherent states actually satisfy some very desirable conditions to be considered semi-classical also at late times. And then the second thing that we want is we have to choose this function that we have in our coherent state. And namely, we choose a Gaussian peaking function. So we basically peak around one value of our k-modes. And in particular, because we're interested in cosmology, we want to peak around the homogeneous mode. So the homogeneous mode is represented by k is equal to 0. So now again, we kind of have a highly peaked state where the modes that have k is equal to 0 are most excited. Because otherwise, we're not going to get something that is homogeneous or exactly homogeneous at the classical level. So the important thing to maybe point out here is that from this construction, you actually have a slight difference, or maybe a big difference, to the classical case, where this is all exactly homogeneous at the background level at least. But in this quantum case, you can't directly separate the background from the perturbations. Because if we only had exactly homogeneous mode, this S would have to be, infinite, and we'd just have to peak on one mode. But instead, we'll always have a Gaussian, so some kind of long wavelength modes will always be excited as well. So now that we've picked a state, we can start comparing to the classical theory. So the classical currents here are given by the conjugate momentum of the clock field, and then the diagonal terms are just given by the scale factor to the power 4 and with the ratio to the clock field. So this specific form of J is only valid in this relational coordinate system that we have to choose and this identification that we want to make between the classical side and the expectation values of our operators are obviously only valid in this specific relational coordinate system. Okay. So now we can go and see what we get. So in particular, for the 0,0 component from our G of T such n tensor, we also get something that is constant and just dependent on the initial conditions. So this B and this A were turned up in this Gaussian that we chose for our state. Then we find that the diagonal or the off-diagonal components of the expectation values for GFT stress energy tensor for the state are exactly zero. So we kind of reproduce that part as well. And then by the identification of this component with the diagonal parts and some rearranging, we can reconstruct some effective dynamics for the scale factor as well. Okay. So the interesting thing that we can point out is that instead of just looking at the Friedmann equation, because we actually have access to the, or we propose to have access to the complete metric, we see that the metric is actually spatially flat. So our off-diagonal components are exactly zero. And the other thing that's interesting to see is that in principle, the signs that we get depend on the choice of our initial conditions. So I have to impose that that b squared is larger than a squared in order to have the different signs in my j.
Don't you start with a Lorentzian or a Euclidean model?
So in this case, in the quantum theory, we didn't put anything that could already assume what kind of space-time we reproduce. So here, the signature that we get in the end really depends on the initial conditions of our state.
So you start with, so you just take SE2 group elements, and the action for the SE2 group elements is the same as for BF?
So you just have, the two values the two values of k that we have in our expansion, we don't fix this explicitly, but what you usually find is that the zeroth term can be taken to be some Laplace Bartomi operator on SU2, and then the other term that multiplies this Laplacian on R4 is just a constant. So that's kind of what we put in, where there's no explicit assumption on whether it should be Lorentzian or Euclidean.
And so here, the right hand side completely depends on the state, or the m squared is something in the model you choose.
Yes. So the m squared depends on this, on the values of k0 and k2. So the sign of this will depend on that. So remember when I talked about how we can have two different Hamiltonians? We said we can have a squeezing Hamiltonian or an oscillating Hamiltonian. So in order to have a squeezing Hamiltonian, we need a specific sign of m. But the point here is not so much like the absolute sign. So for instance, if we found that there was a minus here, this identification that we have between the classical current and the GFT energy tensor, if there was a sign difference, that wouldn't really be that difficult, because it depends a bit on how we define our GFT energy tensor and these kind of things. The important thing is really that in order to have a Lorentzian signature, the expectation values of T00 and TAA need to have a different sign. So this guy here is identified with this expectation value of the 00 component.
So you need B squared minus, no, you need M squared to be negative?
No, so if you take this on the other side, right, so this goes here, then we see that if we have B squared, so T00 here has a negative sign. So the sign of T00, TAA is fixed. Sorry. And yes, so if we had, yes, so if this was negative, and TAA is also negative, then T00 and TAA would both be negative. So the point is that this quantity here is identified with TAA, okay? And it has a minus sign. Now, if this quantity here is identified with T00, but actually A squared is larger than B squared, there would also be a minus sign. And then the classical current that we reconstruct would have a minus sign everywhere, which would mean that we have something like Euclidean signature, where whether it's all minus or plus is not really important here. It's just the relative difference of these signs.
You go one slide back. Sure. you're saying that you solve this field equation to get the sigma k, is that?
No, so sigma k is...
it's a choice.
There's a choice that we have for our coherent state.
Then you just solve for A and B, is that what you're solving?
No, so here we're not solving for anything, right? So what we the dynamics is what we get before. So the dynamics are completely determined by the different operators, right? So you have the Hamiltonian and you have your operators, and they will give you the dynamics also of your operators. But now when you take the expectation value, you have to choose a specific state that your operators act on. So in this case, we choose a state that is a coherent state with respect to these time-independent operators. And this we have to choose. So we have some kind of function that we can pick, and we pick this function to represent some, what we think needs to be represented to have a homogeneous cosmology. So this is a choice. So A and B are also completely arbitrary real values, which in the beginning we don't know which ones to pick. But then if we, like once we do the computation, we see that if we want to reconstruct something with the right signature, we have to impose some conditions on these initial conditions that we have. Okay, so now from this identification, we have an effective expression for a scale factor. And from this, we can look to see what kind of effective Friedmann equation we actually find. So the result for the effective Friedmann equation is this guy over here, where we use the expressions to rewrite it in terms of our scale factor and our pi zero again. And then we find that if we go to late times, the scale factor increases, so we get just a constant.
And how do you get the Friedmann equation? Because you have the A now.
Yes. So you say that... So you have A, and the dynamical equation of A is fixed from your quantum theory. So chi zero is your time coordinate.
Okay, so you just take time derivative.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
H.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. So this is how we reconstruct our effective Friedmann equation, and then we can compare this to what we get in general relativity if we only had a single scalar field. So this is what most GFT did before as well, to compare to this Friedmann equation, where we also just have a constant. And then we can see that if we fix our value of m squared to be related to kappa or g specifically in a specific way, we would get the correct late time limit of our Friedmann equation. We can also compare this to other results in GFT, where we don't have four fields, but we just had a single field. So this is the one massive scalar field that gives us a clock. And this is the more general kind of equation that one can find in this in those scenarios. So here y is a negative constant. So in both of these, you can get a bounce. And then you can also have an additional term that goes with 1 over a cubed, which we kind of got rid of here because we had to do some normal ordering with respect to our operators, which if you don't do that, you actually get this additional term.
So you say single scalar field,
mm-hmm.
but then you have four scalar fields. Why don't you compare?
Yes, because I will do that in a second, because we actually find something quite different. So at this point, it's saying that, okay, so I get an effective Friedmann equation. And if I look at the late time limit, I recover the general relativistic Friedmann equation with a single scalar field. That is the statement at this point. And I also recover the late time limit of any kind of GFT where I have a single scalar field. Okay, fair enough. Something I would just want to point out before we continue is that, before we got the scale factor from the expectation value of the volume operator, which is also proportional to the number operator. So there was the relation of a to the power of 3 with this number operator, which is also why in our effective Friedmann equations we get these powers of a to the 6 or a to the 3. Now, in the kind of identification that we have, we find that actually a to the 4 goes with the number operator, because if we go back... So this dynamical part of A is really, again, just the number operator, or the number operator that you also find in all other approaches to GFT. And therefore, we have this different identification of the scale factor and the number operator, and therefore, we actually get the A to the 8 instead of the A to the 6 term in our effective Friedman equation. OK, so now we go back to the point that Bianca just pointed out. Actually, we have three other spatial fields, so we should really compare to GR with three spatial fields. And here, the thing is that the gradients of these spatial fields and the way we fix the relational coordinate system will actually contribute to our effective Friedman equation. So without the fields, we just had a constant term, but now we also get these additional A to the 4 terms in the first and second Friedman equation. OK, so initially one might think, OK, maybe there's some kind of intermediate regime where I can say that this term is like very small. Maybe if I pick my initial conditions for pi 0 to be very large, and in like the region where A is still quite small, maybe around the bounds, these can be neglected. However, if we look at the Friedman equation we find, there's no such freedom, and we actually find that the bounds happens exactly when this ratio is 1.
Just a stupid question. So if you put three scalar fields, you have to assume that they are just linear in the coordinates?
Yes. So
they stay linear on the time evolution in GR?
Yes, so the idea here is that, the assumption that we make is that you can define at least locally this relational coordinate system at all times and at each point in your classical framework, so that you can always say that chi corresponds exactly to your coordinate, so that the gradient in chi direction will always be 1.
Yeah, I'm asking if that's a fact in the GR dynamics. If I just take GRs,
yes,
GR is 4 scalar fields,
mm-hmm.
And I guess I assume that at some initial points, chi is just proportional to the coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
That
if you're saying if under evolution this property will remain.
Is the case under evolution? I don't know. I mean, it does not contribute to the. No, it can contribute to the energy. So
the reason why we have this is because the stress energy tensor on the classical side actually sees the contribution of these gradient energies, mm-hmm. right? Because what I've said is I still want to assume that these fields are. Well, the fields are not homogeneous, but the gradients are homogeneous because the gradients are just 1. And the gradients are the only thing that enters my classical theory, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, OK, it's still this question whether it remains under evolution, but it's quite possible that it does remain under.
I think it should, because because the evolution will just be given by your Klein-Gordon equation, and this should not change the gradients in any way.
Albert's Klein-Gordon equation very roughly tells me there's stuff oscillating. So.
Okay, yes, maybe.
Again, can you put it in initial condition so that they are not oscillating? OK, well, I think it's something one can check. So.
Yes, OK. So. Okay, so yes, so at the classical scenario, actually, these gradients that I get, that I need to be able to reconstruct my relational coordinate system, do actually contribute to my classical stress energy tensor. Therefore, I get some changes in my Friedman equation, which are not represented by the effective Friedman equations that we reconstruct. So, like I said before, from this kind of Friedman equation, we only get the generativistic Friedman equation with a single master scalar field. Okay, so. The first thing to point out is that all other kind of GFT, or the mean field approaches that I talked about before, there was a major difference in the sense that they had the same relational coordinate system, but they also included a fifth scalar field that they assumed to dominate at late times. So in GR, if I have a fifth field that dominates the energy density, so I can neglect all of these, then I will again reproduce the correct limit and actually get the... gets a Friedman equation even in GR that looks like I just have a single field, and then we'll agree with the GFT approach. But on the more conceptual side, there's some conflict here, because in GFT, we kind of chose our initial state to be peaked around the k equals 0 mode, and all the contributions that we could have from our from our relational fields would be exactly in the inhomogeneous modes. So kind of by definition, we have reduced to the single field homogeneous case again, which is something that on the generativistic side, we can't really do. So maybe we'll have to choose a different type of state, and this is probably something that should be explored further in the future. Okay, so this concludes the discussion about just the homogeneous background cosmology and this effective metric.
So is this what people have done generally to discuss perturbation? Was always this approach?
Sorry?
It was always this kind of approach to derive the dynamics of perturbations in GFT?
Yeah, so the difference is... No, of course.
I've not read it, so I'm just to ask whether that was what people have done.
Yeah, so what people have done usually is, okay, the dynamics come from a different point, is to have exactly like some coherent state, to have a relational coordinate system, and then to have these different modes of your relational coordinate system to represent the perturbations. So what we've so this is what I'm going to talk about in a second, of how we can also treat perturbations in this framework. But so far, the idea was just to have these different operators. So these are new, like this GFT stress energy tensor is nothing people have studied before. And the previous approaches, they also find the same kind of contribution from these spatial fields. But again, if I have another field that kind of dominates, I can maybe neglect them at late times.
And so the parameters which go in is just m squared, which is k0 divided by k2,
mm-hmm.
and then a and b in the Gaussian state.
So for what we're doing at this point, yes, exactly. So it's really just the, So these expectation values will just depend on, yes, K0, K2, B and A, when I look at the homogeneous background, right? So once I start looking at other modes, I also have K dependence in these dynamics, which I think, so in the other approaches to these GFT perturbations, I think there might be some more parameters also with respect to the peaking functions, but I'm not sure, because there again, so you have this in the approach that is similar to ours, but then once you start, so this most recent paper that has different types of tetrahedra, you also, I think, have some kind of entanglement between them, which will depend on some more conditions, and you get some additional parameters that you can fix. But here, yeah, it's just A, B, and M, basically.
Just to let you know, you have like 5 to 10 minutes.
So I'll rush through the perturbations to not keep you for too long. So maybe before I go into some details about perturbations, I'm just going to talk a bit more about the bigger picture, kind of what I've said and kind of what we might think might be interesting in the future. So I said, okay, we have some proposal for a GFT effective metric, which depends on different things. So there's some details in the theory, like how many scalar fields do we couple, how do we couple them, and then it also depends on the type of state that I choose, where I said this is what actually chooses our physical scenario. So I talked about how this can be applied to cosmology, and namely what we get just for the background cosmology. Now, as I've mentioned originally, we might want to try this kind of proposal for different spacetimes. So maybe the most obvious ones we can think of is black holes or some Bianchi spacetimes. And maybe if we want some inhomogeneity, we could think of some Gaussian state that has a preferred direction where we don't peak exactly on k equals zero or something similar. So this is something that can definitely be explored. So what I was planning to talk about in the next few minutes maybe is how, once we have applied this to cosmology, we can also look at different types of perturbations. And in particular, because we actually have access to like a whole kind of metric, we can look at gauge invariant perturbations, which is if you only have the perturbed volume element, it's not that straightforward. And once you have gauge invariant perturbations, you can then maybe connect to something like the CMB and other observations. Right, and then another thing that once you have perturbations, you can have this additional kind of consistency check where there's, I don't know if some of you might have heard of it, there's a thing called the separate universe picture. So if you look at very long wavelength perturbations, you can treat perturbation as almost homogeneous, and you can make some more generic statements that in particular any kind of proposal should fall back to just by consistency arguments. And then if I keep to do this and I want to dream a little bit, I could say that actually I also have this whole big classical plethora of models where we do modified gravity, and I can apply this to cosmology, and I can get perturbations, and I can gauge invariant perturbations. So if from my quantum side, I can also study gauge invariant perturbations, and I see some modifications to the dynamics of these perturbations, maybe I can draw some similarities with some other classical models. Again, dreaming about the future. Okay, so let me just talk about, okay, how from the approach that we have, we could actually get some perturbations. So in cosmology, you perturb your line element, where now you have this inhomogeneous functions, which are here phi, b, psi, and e. And then instead of only looking at the k equals zero mode for our GFTSS energy tensor, we actually look at k not equal to zero modes and make the same kind of identification to now get dynamics for these variables. And then by inversion, we can actually get some dynamics for b, e, psi, and phi explicitly. Okay. Sorry, how long did you say I have? Okay, so maybe let me skip this. So this was just maybe to say that, so we talked a bit about how this whole relational framework introduces some maybe problems or some new features in the GFT effect of Friedmann equation. It also introduces some additional features in the perturbations on the classical side, where in particular you kind of get non-adiabatic perturbations. That is something that if you're interested in cosmology or you talk to some cosmologists, they might not like a lot. So there's some more things to, or some caveats also on the classical side of this theory. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we compare dynamics that we get also from our GFT-NZ tensor with some classical kind of dynamics, we also find different discrepancies. And maybe one last thing I can say is, okay, so I mentioned a bit the separate universe picture, which was something that we talked about, that we studied in the early phases of my PhD, where the idea was really to say that, okay, if I have a quantum gravity theory, I can get an effective Friedmann equation. But having perturbations from quantum gravity directly is usually not that easy and not that straightforward. I talked an hour about how we might actually get to perturbations starting from the fundamental theory. So the question that we asked was a bit, if I just have a modified Friedmann equation where maybe I have some generic function f that give me some modifications, could I actually use this to say something about perturbations? And the idea is that if I look at very long wavelength perturbations, I can usually neglect any kind of gradients. And therefore, if I just perturb the Friedmann equation very naively at linear order, I can get something like a changed equation of motion for my perturbations. And then from this, we can actually look at gauge invariant perturbations, which, like I mentioned before, are those that are actually physical and you can connect to things like the CMB. In particular, we looked at the co-moving curve perturbation and zeta. And then we can see if these kind of modifications already say something about the dynamics of these guys. Well, in particular, zeta will always be conserved when you have adiabatic perturbations, at least on long wavelengths. And then just as a first consistency check, we can try to relate this to these effective expressions that we get in our approach. Namely by, okay, kind of for now, ignoring a lot of these k-dependent terms. And then particularly for zeta, we find that this will just be related to the 0,0 component of our GFT-NZ tensor, which is also constant. So, okay, maybe we have some like a first consistency check there, which is something that needs to be extended a bit further as well. Okay, let me skip this. And let me just come to the conclusion to not run over time. So, so what did I say? I talked of how we have GFT as a background in an approach to quantum gravity, and we can apply it to cosmology in different types of ways. What we did here specifically is we introduced some new operators from the GFT stress energy tensor, where the stress energy tensor comes from the symmetry that we have with respect to the scalar fields that we couple to have a relational coordinate system. And once we have this effective metric, we can actually, well, do a lot more and compare to GR in a lot more ways. We applied this to cosmology, and we got the effective Friedmann equation for a single scalar field, so we don't actually capture these generalistic effects that come from these matter fields. And then, okay, we had some first results about cosmological perturbations, which still has to be strengthened in the future. So obviously in this whole process, we had a lot of types of simplifications. Namely, the whole time we looked at like a single GFT mode. So maybe if we have some additional types of modes, we can have a mix of oscillating and squeezing modes, we can get some new phenomenology in the early universe. And then also, throughout this whole time, we neglected interactions, which makes things a lot more difficult, but also actually changed the dynamics. So there was some studies of like how, at some point, obviously, this regime where I can neglect interactions will break down, and there's some significant changes also to the Friedman equation. So the question is always like, which range are these simplifications applicable, and in which range do we expect maybe G of T to not hold anymore, and maybe have some classical theory take over? But these are all things that, well, should be understood a lot better. Okay, so there's another thing that one can do. So like I said, maybe one can cure this difference in this effect of Friedman equations by adding a fifth matter field. Now, in our approach, that would also obviously also mean we have some additional components of a stress energy tensor or the classical currents on the classical side, and the interpretation of those is not so clear. Then also we can look at different types of state choices. So now we really chose to peek around the homogeneous mode, but maybe some other peaking will make more sense or recover some different kind of effective dynamics, and we want to look at other space times. And then, well, if we wanted to connect to observables, we can push this and actually get some dynamics of gauge invariant quantities and see what they mean, for instance, for the SIMB or something similar. Okay, so this brings me to the end. I guess we already had a lot of questions, but if there's any more, please let me know.
So the scalar fields are heavily used in this approach.
Yes, they're very important to this whole approach, that's true.
Yeah, is there a way to move away from that, or do you think we really need these scalar fields?
Okay, so that's an interesting...
Something which is maybe hidden, or is it kind of, I don't know, the Higgs field?
So if I wanted something that is not a massive scalar field, I would have to figure out a way how to connect this to the tetrahedron, all these kind of things, which is maybe not very straightforward. I think there have been some ideas of how to have different types of matter. Okay, I'm not so sure. So in that sense, if I want to really use maybe my scalar fields to have a relational coordinate system, I don't know how we can move away from that. More generally, I guess this whole setup is still quite simplistic, right? So I have one type of isotropic tetrahedra. Like you said, I kind of locally put my additional scalar fields to hope to do some perturbations with this, and I've neglected all kinds of interactions. So maybe I could also think of maybe I want to have a more complicated simplicial complex with different types of tetrahedra, and that should maybe represent inhomogeneity in a much more, I don't know, in a better way in that sense. Which is something that, okay, is quite different to what has been done so far and would definitely be interesting also to explore. I mean, there's also some ideas of how you can have so in color GFTs, or can you have certain graphs of connected tetrahedra that maybe correspond to a certain topology? So there's these kinds of avenues to explore. But if you want to stay with this, which is in some way nice because it's straightforward and it's not that difficult to actually connect to some phenomenology. So if you want to make this connection to cosmology, I think this is quite a promising idea.
Excuse me.
You said it's area adiabatic cosmology. If you have more than one scalar field, then you don't have any more adiabaticity, like the conservation of the zeta anymore. So that's the limit that you only have one degree of freedom. Definitely you need that. You may break down that. And you have more than one in that, did you or not?
Sorry, I'm not sure. So yes, okay, so in cosmology, if you have more than one scalar field, yes, you get non-adiabaticities as well, right? But I think there's some stringent constraints on how much you can really have when you look at measurements and these kinds of things.
No, the observations that you shouldn't have more than
exactly,
that's
yes.
Right. But then in your approach, did you have more than one or not? Because you were trying to, you said you satisfy the conservation of zeta.
Oh. No, sorry. So this is, okay, so what I said here was really if I want to look at the separate universe picture where I neglect all kind of gradients, and I also assume That's okay. So on the GR side, I'll have something that is adiabatic, because okay. So where I come from here is saying that in my GFT, I reproduce the effective Friedmann equation of a single scalar field at late times. So maybe I also, when I look at perturbations, maybe I should look at the GR case with a single scalar field, and then I get this kind of conservation. If I want to do what you said before, so if I really want to connect to so the GR side where you have where you do have the whole relational coordinate system, I will definitely have something like non-adiabaticities, but at the moment all the GFT construction does not reproduce any of this, right? So there's something to be understood of really how to if one can or how one can reproduce GR results in this relational coordinate system.
Okay. And then there was like when you write metrics, so in cosmology, the way we sometimes do this thing, if we have a clock, mm-hmm. then I first fix the gauge on that clock. Mm-hmm. And then in your metric, instead of having just A squared, which is F or W, then you get the A squared times E to the zeta, where you allow some spatial variance, therefore, in okay. your zeta. Zeta shows in the metric directly.
Oh, that's quite interesting. So I haven't encountered this before, but okay, no, I think it's quite far back. But so in this case here, we really just fix the lapse in the shift from this relational coordinate system, so it completely fixes your gauge as well. Mm-hmm.
But then the advantage of that is you incorporate the perturbation already in your, so you don't, then I guess you already, when you take the expectation value of your mm-hmm. Volume element, you go directly to homogeneous limit. But I'm wondering, isn't that possible that you also do something like we do? We say it's A squared times E to the zeta, and zeta has some spatial dependence. So already my operator has some spatial dependence. You don't have to.
Okay, so so maybe we can talk about this in a bit more detail. So, because I don't know if I really understand. So the point here, right, is that we have some like this type of metric, right?
Yeah. So now you're writing it in what's usually called longitudinal gauge, or the format is suitable for that. Mm-hmm. But if you choose your clock, so that your scalar field hypersurfaces are homogeneous, then this becomes like you only have one zeta directly shows up there, so it becomes A squared times E to the 2 zeta, and okay. Instead of that psi, or psi is basically part of your zeta.
Interesting. Yeah, okay, so I mean at this point, right, I haven't really chosen the gauge because I still have like my B and E variables explicitly, so if I had a longitudinal gauge. So what I'm saying is that, okay, so the relational coordinate system fixes things like N, right, so it will fix the lapse because we've chosen a specific time coordinate. And then, yeah, so I have not thought about how this could be rewritten.
Then can you fix the gauge first, and then you do your operation, volume operation? And then, because when you define your A operator, there was already K dependence in there, right? Because you chose the, your volume operator was some E to the Gaussian K minus K naught, which you said, like, at the like zero mode is mm-hmm. homogeneous, mm-hmm. and for non-zero mode you have the K dependence there.
Yes.
So if you have non-homogeneities, you would have additional contribution already in there in the.
So okay, so maybe I misunderstand, but kind of this so the construction of the. Of what we get from the GFT side or from the quantum theory, right? It doesn't. It really, the only assumption that goes in to go to cosmology is the choice of state that we have. So we have this Gaussian that is peaked around k equals zero. So maybe this is not a good choice, and I can choose a different kind of state that will lead to different things. Okay, but that's really what fixes the functional form and also the time dependence of these functions over here. Now this is as far as I know is like a good way to just. Well, write a perturbed metric in general, right, with different degrees of freedom, where, okay, here we just have scalar perturbations. And now it's really this naive identification with these metric components and our, the dynamics that we get from it.
Why don't you quantize the whole A squared times 1 minus 2 psi, like instead of just quantizing A?
Okay, so The idea is not, okay, I don't take anything on the classical side and quantize this, right? So I already have constructed something that is an operator on my quantum theory that like knows nothing about the metric. It's really this identification with this classical current that gives me something like the metric. Now, this split into...
Yeah, when you do the identification, why do you identify with A, not the whole thing?
Ah, so we do identify with the whole thing. Okay. Okay, so this identification will always come really from the metric component, right? So I have some identification of the TABs with the GABs. And then it depends on what my GAB actually looks like. So it will always be the whole thing. Let me just think. Yes, okay. So okay, you have to remember that this identification is really for the classical currents. So these currents will depend on these kind of metric components. But it doesn't really matter. I don't know how to explain this, sorry. Right, so I really said...
I don't know, maybe...
Yeah, we can discuss it.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
If anyone has any quick things to say. If not, thank you, sir, again.